What's up, OUXers? So today we're talking to Michael Metz and Andy Welfley. They are the authors of Writing is Designing, which is a book that I just finished. I actually tore through it. It's awesome. You should definitely get it. Totally applies to object-oriented UX, but especially if you're one of those OUXers out there that is more into content strategy and UX writing, this is going to be an awesome book for you. So I actually found out about this book from somebody in the object-oriented UX community recommending it to me, and then that happened again. And then I learned that Michael and Andy actually talk about object-oriented UX in their UX writing workshops and have recommended the masterclass to the folks that are in their workshops. So I was like, okay, I got to read this book and I got to talk to these guys. The book's awesome, and Michael and Andy are also amazing people. I really hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So Michael, he's given talks, he's taught workshops on UX writing and content strategy at industry conferences all around the world. While Andy is usually doing that, they are doing those workshops together. They are co-facilitating those. Andy is also a speaker and also a content strategist at Adobe on their product design team. He says he writes under huge constraints and uncovers artifacts from big old software interfaces, which kind of throws back to his childhood of wanting to be a paleontologist. So if you were there for my conversation with Ren Pope, where we talk about information archaeology, Andy's right on that wavelength on kind of digging away at the truth within crazy information environments. My only real announcement for you today is that next week, we've got the Design at Scale conference. So Bram Wessel and I are doing our Enterprise OUX workshop. And actually, during this conversation, I was kind of killing two birds with one stone because I wanted to have some sort of like design challenge that Andy and Michael and I could sink our teeth into and I could sort of ask questions around. So I actually just used the design challenge that Bram and I are going to be using next week at the conference. The design challenge is something called Golden Homes. It's a concept that is serving senior citizens that don't want to live in an assisted living facility, but also don't want to live alone. So it's kind of like a roommate matching system for senior citizens. So that's the concept that sort of kind of drives a lot of the conversation that you'll be hearing today in the episode. And also, if you decide that you want to come to the workshop next week, you'll actually be digging your teeth into this design challenge from an enterprise information architecture standpoint. So you can use the discount code PRATER-DAS2021 to get, how much do you get? So you get $75 off of that. So that's a pretty awesome deal. So make sure to check the show notes for the link and of course that discount code. If you want to sign up last minute, there are a few spaces left for next week. So we'd love to see you there. This is a great way to kind of get your hands dirty with object-oriented UX, especially if you are working in an enterprise environment. The workshop is 10 hours over the course of 3 days. So it's kind of nicely broken up. So it's 4 hours on June 2nd, 4 hours on June 3rd, and then a 2-hour session on June 4th. Really fun, really good stuff. Hope to see you there. All right, let's go ahead and jump into the conversation. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of object-oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Michael Metz and Andy Welfley, welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Great to be here.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm really excited to geek out on this book, this amazing book that y'all wrote together. Writing is Designing. My copy is incredibly marked up. So we're here to talk mostly about the questions that came out of this book. So the first question that I have for y'all is kind of if you could go back and give me some insight on why you decided to write this book. Like, what was going on in your careers? What were you seeing in the industry? What were sort of the big problems that you were hoping that this book would help UX writers, UX designers, anybody that is creating words in our industry? What were those big problems that you were seeing that you were like, this is what this book is hopefully going to solve for?
Yeah. Well, it all started when I was two. No, I'm just kidding. Michael and I, actually, this book came out of a series of workshops that we were doing, and we had met at Confab in 2015. And we actually had met at a previous workshop that he was teaching and I was attending, but we reconnected there. And we realized it was there was not a lot of writing for products in that particular content strategy conference. We were at Confab at the time, which was very not focused on product content strategy. And we were talking about the stuff that we wished we would have been able to like learn at this conference. And basically just turned into a conversation of like, well, why don't we pitch that idea, pitch that conference, or pitch that workshop talk. So we did, and it just happened to be, I think, the right thing at the right time. A lot of people were looking for this, and it was very much presented as learn how to work on voice and tone strategies for your work. Mm-hmm. And we covered a lot of other things too. We covered a lot of UX writing fundamentals like collaboration and research and prototyping and like the stuff that accompanies that. The voice and tone is like the, you know, slightly more sexy part.
Yeah.
So we did that, did a lot of those, went to a couple different countries, went to Singapore and did a 2-day version of this workshop. And eventually we were connected to Lou Rosenfeld from Rosenfeld Media, who was looking for a book in this topic. And that's kind of where this came about. So, you know, it seems like a lot of people write a book and then develop a series of workshops based on that book. And we kind of went the opposite direction here.
That's so cool to hear. I mean, I basically am and following in your footsteps. One of the things that I always tell people is teach what you need to learn. And yeah. It sounds like that was exactly what happened. You wished you were learning. This is the type of thing that you wanted to be learning. And it was, you saw it as a gap. And said, okay, well, how about we go learn it and teach it?
Yeah.
And then through teaching it, that turned into the book opportunity to kind of distill all of that down into a book. So,
yeah.
Cool. And when you were thinking that you wanted to learn this, to even take it a step back, you would say, this is something that I wish I was learning. Why do you wish you were learning some more of that product content strategy? As opposed to the content that you were hearing at the conference at the time.
Yeah, so I think a lot of what you would learn if you went to a content strategy conference or attended the content strategy track at a UX conference was about like how to audit a giant website, how to, you know, keep track of governance over time and corral your stakeholders around like these pages. And what we were seeing was a need for people to be experts at the language we were using in deeply interactive experiences with lots of different states and logic and, the way apps work, you know, things like that. That's the type of work we were doing. And we weren't seeing it very much. And I think one of the reasons it was so important is because a lot of writers who get into that type of role don't realize that they are UX designers, right? Like they're UX designers who use words primarily. That's their craft, but they need to understand those methods like research. They need to understand how to test what they're doing. They need to understand the need to be objective about what they're creating and adapt it based on what they're learning. And those were all things that we learned, I think, maybe the hard way in our own careers and wanted other people to have a bit of a shortcut as they were getting started. So we were really focused on the newcomer writers, especially who were really strong in writing, but maybe not as strong in thinking about this as a UX practice for themselves.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I mean, if you think about your traditional content inventory or content audit, those are usually organized around page or URL. And often I haven't seen a lot of that where it actually talks about the different states of that page or the things that might be on that page and how those could be in different states based on some conditional logic or where the user is coming from. So you saw that need for some tools and some methodologies, particularly around that kind of that level of complexity.
Yeah.
So, and so for everybody that's listening, so Andy answered the first question, Michael answered the second question, so you can calibrate voices, but now we'll, to help you calibrate voices a little bit better. Andy, I have a question for you. So you said that you've always been a writer at your core, but it was in college when you were working on, working as a newspaper editor, that you started getting really interested in the systems, and I'm quoting you here, the systems in which words actually, actually do a lot of the work. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about how UX writing is so much, we were just sort of talking about this, about how it's about the words working in context of a system and, you know, figuring out, okay, I have a bunch of words I need to write. I need to understand the system, but then also about how words can help create the system and define the system. Can you talk a little bit about that realization?
Yeah. In fact, I was just showing not too long ago, I work pretty closely with our design system team at Adobe, and I was just showing them my college senior journalism minor project, which was developing a style guide for the student newspaper I was working at. And I was looking through it, and I was noticing how I was documenting components, and I was like naming them and how they fit in the system. I was like, I was working on like a newspaper design system back in 2005. Wow. That was really, really fun. Yeah, you're right. I think in college, I really kind of fell in love with the idea of a style, like a style book, right? Like I myself am a big fan, still am, of the AP style book and the way that they were documenting things, but they weren't necessarily letting it sort of be this stodgy canonical text, right? Like it's always evolving and changing and being relevant to its customers, to its users. And I think sort of like the meta challenge there of naming, like, not only are you like instructing people how to use words when you're writing in journalism, writing in a newspaper, but also you're sort of like naming and identifying when those systems are appearing in the text, in the layout, and then bringing it back, right? Like, hey, this is something that is an agate text, and this is how you structure a lead paragraph, and this is how you think about the like the inverted pyramid, right, of like what you're writing about. I think all of those things are directly translatable to UX writing, and even like, you know, philosophically related, right? You're understanding the presentation and the system of the language that you're writing kind of based on what you need, like what your user needs, what your audience needs. Have you ever heard, I don't know if you've ever been in journalism, but have you ever heard that phrase, like, write for the Kansas City milkman, which is like an old timey thing that, like, you know, Kansas City milkman, I'm sure very smart, but like it was their way of saying, like, you know, make sure that this is accessible to everyone.
Right.
And that's directly related to accessibility and making sure that like your writing is usable.
Yeah.
Which is an important part.
So it's like that, that you said that kind of that meta task of designing the rules and the guidelines and the frameworks around how the writing will actually happen.
Yeah.
And that's, yep. Yeah, and that helps teams. I mean, the reason I love system design so much is because it helps us be focused on the places where we should be worrying about the creativity and not reinventing the wheel over and over and over again.
Just every time. Yeah. I mean, I hear so many people talking about like designing systems as like, oh, you're just, you know, shoehorning a designer into just like, you know, rearranging Lego blocks. And that is not true at all. That's just like, you know, it's not that you're like being given Lego blocks in order to build a thing. It's that you're just like casting the plastic in in predefined shapes. So you don't have to reinvent the Lego every time.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So not just really to contrast to systems, but Michael, you said how you love how words and images come together to tell a story. And often with system design, we're trying to get away from kind of that that linear process, of which usually is fraught with a lot of assumptions, like the user is going to do this, and then they're going to go to this step, and then they're going to do this step. And maybe we'll have a little like there's step 3A and step 3B, but really we're trying to push the user through some sort of funnel where often I like to think about the systems that I design and the environments that I design as more of a spider web of navigation. than that linear type of navigation or hierarchical navigation. Even when somebody's in a flow, how can they kind of, you know, get out of that flow or change flows? Where do you think, like, how do you leverage or pull in that storytelling when we're when we have so many of our experiences now are nonlinear?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is people want their interfaces to work like stories so badly, right? Like we have the journey maps. We have, I think we have like story mapping, which applies journey mapping thinking to like creation of user stories and things like that. So people really, really want it. But as you said, when you get into it, you realize, okay, someone might just actually start in their account and might never see this initial screen at all. So I think what you have to do as the writer and kind of what I've done is like try to keep the big picture in front of people, try to keep the narrative in front of people and make sure that's not tied to those assumptions you mentioned about how they're using the interface. So we can still tell a story to the user. It might just be like we need to make it contextually relevant when they're here looking at their account. And we need to be aware that they may not have seen the messages that you worked so hard on earlier, right? So I think it's still totally fine to be thinking about like when we want to disclose things, moving through it in kind of a linear fashion. But it really has to be peppered with, okay, did we make an assumption about what messages people saw? It's okay to explain this thing four times, right? Like it's okay because we're not sure when people are going to see it. And it's better that they have the information than to not have it. So your approach, when I read that article on A List Apart, it made so much sense to me because I was like, yeah, people don't use interfaces the way we think. You know, they could be coming at it from any point. So as a writer, that means I need to keep what we want to communicate in front of our team all the time and be aware that there may be many moments where we need to communicate those things.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we often say, or I often think about when I'm identifying the objects in a system that I want to make really clear to the users, like, here's the things here that you should know about. And hopefully those things seem really familiar to you because you're already working in this problem domain. Those almost seem like the characters in the story. And sometimes the user is a character in the story. You know, usually if it's a social app, they actually are an object within the system, interacting with those things in a way where actually they're seeing other people. They're more like on stage with the other objects. And then you have, then you sometimes have the user as more of what we've been calling in the OUX masterclass, we've been calling it the conductor role or the director role, where they're sitting in the other, they're sitting the front row of the audience. They're kind of telling the things what to do and where to go, and maybe even creating some instances of those things. So always having that assumption that, or having the assumption that you don't know what is going on with what the user is thinking and how they actually are even having relationships with those things or how they might be connecting the things in their mind. So going back to like figuring out, okay, what is the user's mental model is very important, and what the things, how they see the things, but it's also very important to understand how the business sees the thing and the business's process model. So one thing, to pull a direct quote from the book, you say, to bring clarity to your users, you have to start bringing clarity to your team. And I was just fist pumping when I read that. I often say that's the one thing that OUX does so well, is it helps get the team aligned. I mean, one of the things that we do is we build glossaries. So how does good UX writing help bring clarity to a team? And do you have any stories on how maybe you've brought clarity to teams?
It is pretty mind-blowing how often a product team starts designing something without understanding why they're designing it. Like, oh yeah, like we're, you know, just asking like, what problem are we solving with this, is just something that sometimes people get answers. So I think UX writing is just information, right? Like you're encoding information for people. And that is something that you can really easily turn back to the team you're working with and act a little bit like a journalist, if we want to go back to that earlier skill or metaphor. Everybody writes it, right? Everybody at a product company has to communicate with each other, and that's through Slack and through emails. And so everybody can write, but not a lot of people can distill information and summarize and just like document for everyone to see. So it is a really good way to show your impact early on a product team. Like if you're a writer on that team, to just like spend a little time interviewing your stakeholders and understanding like why you're working on this thing you're working on, and if we're here to solve a problem, are there insights from research that we already have or that we need in order to show why it is that we're doing this thing, and just put that together into a easily consumable document and kind of refer back to it. I mean, some people treat it like they're making a mission statement for the team or some kind of a vision statement. Mm. And some people just be like, hey, I'm just trying to like do some research here before I jump in so I have better understanding of what's happening, and then just kind of like share that out to the team. But I think all of those skills you can employ back toward your team as well.
Yeah.
That you might use trying to teach a user what to do.
Michael, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's all great. And one thing to also consider is that the interface itself can be a way to facilitate getting that information. So you could start, one of the things I've done in the past is start by pair writing a screen in the interface. And that gets at the bottom really quickly of like information hierarchy and what's most important for people to know and where we're going to put the call to action and what's the contextual information people need. And that's such a great way to come together as a team before you've done any visual work at all. I love to do that with product engineering, writing, product design, all together in a group to just sort of think through what is this going to be? And it doesn't take long. It's pretty quick.
And so what was it? You said pair writing?
Yeah, in that case, it's more than a pair. It's four people. So I do it like, The practical way I do it is I'll share my screen and write and then give other people turns to edit and iterate on that. So, you know, for the past, like when we're starting a new product project, I will work on that with the key players and they'll have a chance to like say, oh no, that's not right. And they'll change things and iterate on it. And it's just a really powerful method to bring clarity and help people like practice it themselves, practice that clarity gathering.
That's awesome. Andy, going back to like the document that high level document, it seems like you could use that. It would be really great for onboarding too, synthesizing everything. Yeah. Do you have any framework for that? Like, or some like a template, like what are the kind of main sections that you might have for a document like that?
Yeah. I usually try to start with something that feels very much like a creative brief or a project brief or something like you might use when you start a project at an agency. There's a lot of just sort of a description of the problem statement of like what it is that we're trying to, what business problem we're trying to solve. And especially if you're working on like at a company that is like has any age or has like, you're not working on our kind of brand net new thing. You can also sort of like document some of the big evolutions of that product and the timelines along the way for sure. Mm-hmm. This is the last time we tried something like this and it failed spectacularly.
Yes.
Maybe don't say like that, but but certainly kind of outline based on your interviews and your research what it is that has been tried before. And then honestly, I think that something like a almost like an organizational ecosystem map is important too. Mm. Like what are some of the main other products or other parts of the system that this touches and what have they tried? Like, are you duplicating effort that like these guys over here have tried to do? Or are you also solving a big business problem for these folks over here? So I think this can certainly get out of control easily, but like I tend to think just like a project brief with maybe some like, you know, some history and some insights about what's tried before is a really good kind of way to start on that.
So the reason I asked, and that's all really helpful. The reason I ask is we have a document that we use in OUX called an object guide. which is that glossary on steroids. So it's all of the objects, all those main things of value in the system. And we have a definition, but also talk about purpose. Some people kind of bring in some jobs to be done action there. What is the job of this thing? We get into states, like what are the different states of this thing? What are the, can we pull any like KPIs around this thing? How do we measure the success of the thing versus individual instances? All sorts of like a pretty lengthy framework. It can turn into be a pretty crazy document. But one thing that I can see that would be really awesome to add into that would be what you were mentioning. We do have something where we have ownership, like who creates instances of these things, but it would be really interesting to also have team on there. So which team is responsible for this thing, which might be multiple teams? Like what are all the teams that touch this thing or have it? Because a lot of teams are still divided up by page or feature. The thing is objects flow through those pages and those features. I've even seen teams divided up by sections in the journey. So like this team is all about browse and this team is all about purchase and this team is all about manage after you purchased. But the product object or whatever it is going to go through all of that. So to really be clear about here's a thing and here's all the people that might be touching this thing within the, you know, or if we're going to change something, here's who we need to talk to.
Yeah. Sometimes just the act of writing it down or putting it, committing it to like documentation makes it just aligns people better and makes it just kind of like pretty clear, you know, where there may be gaps or where like something really excels. So yeah, I think like so many of our workshop activities are what we call like conversation simulators, mm-hmm. right? Like really, we just want you to like get comfortable talking in the ways that you might when you're trying to define a product voice or you're trying to like have a discussion about like whether or not this thing that you're building includes or excludes people. Like that's conversation simulation is really important because like it just makes it easier to have those real conversations in the future. And I think something like an object map is that exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of like what's one of y'all's favorite conversation simulators?
What do you think, Michael? You're a great conversation simulator.
I feel like
talking to Michael is just like talking to a real person.
Yeah. Besides Andy, I think one of the things I like to do, and I kind of do it differently for each team, but like sometimes I'll do worksheets to capture what's been done so far. And when I write about it in the book, like I actually have a sneaky, like secret agenda when I do this. So one of them is like based on the double diamond, and it's about writing down everything we've done for discovery and everything we've done for delivery. And so it's a way that I, as a writer, will jump into a project and be like, okay, tell me what you've learned about our users so far. And my secret agenda in that is understanding if maybe we haven't done any learning about our users and illustrating it so that it's not me saying, hey, you don't know anything about our users, but it's just this worksheet that I use to get started with a team telling us we don't know much about our users. So that's kind of what I try to do. I always tell people like have an agenda, you know, like have something you're trying to accomplish when you do these conversation simulators, and you should be the person driving it as someone who cares about language and cares about words. That's up to you, and you can really have an impact there.
Oh, I love that. We're so on the same wavelength too, because this is so the process that I teach, I call it the ORCA process, which stands for objects, relationships, calls to action, and attributes. And I put it in the middle of the double diamond. So it's sort of like, I often say, you can ride the killer wave from research into design. But that it also provides this gauntlet so that if you're going through the process, you're going to realize it's a garbage in, garbage out process. If you don't have good research coming in, the process will literally just kick you back to the first diamond. You won't be able to get to the second diamond. And if you're doing it collaboratively, it helps your stakeholders and your subject matter experts and your developers. It helps them come up with the questions. But I actually like what you're doing. I think this is something that for everyone out there using the ORCA process, this is something you should do before that. So to preempt going into an ORCA discovery workshop and getting everybody to come up with the questions and realize, oh, crap, like we actually we're realizing all of our assumptions now, and we do need to go back to research. This seems like a really simple exercise to bubble up that awareness even before you have to go into some sort of discovery workshop and come up with the specifics of all those questions. You can just realize, oh, we haven't done jack to actually get the lay of the land here. And if we go straight into information architecture, God forbid going straight into wireframing or design without doing this stuff, we're going to be basically working on sort of shaky assumptions. Hey y'all, just a quick interruption. As of this recording, we are in the midst of cohort 4 of the OUX certification, and enrollment for cohort 5 won't open up until early summer 2021. But you can dig into all the certification video content, all the templates, all the resources by grabbing access to the OUX Masterclass. And if, after going through the masterclass, you want to get certified, you'll be able to apply the cost of the masterclass to your enrollment in cohort 5. So you can kind of think about it like a down payment. Once you enroll in the masterclass, you'll get access to the OUX Academy. And over the course of 10 weeks, about 2 to 3 hours of video lectures will be released to you each week. But you can consume that content totally at your own pace. You'll have lifetime access to it. So if it takes you 20 weeks to go through it, that's totally fine. You're not just gonna get video content. You're gonna get checklists. You're gonna get exercises. You're gonna get assignments and tons of valuable resources. Basically everything you need to become an expert complexity wrangler. Again, you get everything that a certification cohort gets, just minus all those personal touches. The camaraderie of the cohort in the OUX forum, access to the OUX mentors, the one-on-ones with me, as well as me answering all your questions in the forum and in office hours, and of course the actual certification and a profile on OUX.com. So for all of that, you'll need to actually join a cohort. But you don't have to wait. You can start becoming that complexity wrangling, stakeholder whispering, IA facilitator extraordinaire now. You can start saving yourself and your team countless hours of rework, and you can start saving your user from the extraneous complexity that OUX helps you avoid. So go to OUX.com/certification to learn more. From there, you can get on the waitlist for cohort 5, as well as get yourself access to that entire video library that is the OUX Masterclass. Still not sure if you're ready to take the plunge? Go check out the testimonials on OUX.com. Okay, back to the show. So I want to get into some kind of like tactical questions. So I have an example design challenge. All right. And I'm killing two birds with one stone here. So next week I'm going to be running a workshop with Bram Wessel, who's a information architect out of Seattle, one of the founders of Factor Firm. And we're running this workshop at Rosenfeld's Design at Scale conference. Sort of object-oriented UX at scale. And the design challenge that we're doing next week, I kind of want to use that to ask y'all some questions. Is that cool?
Yeah. It's been a while since I've interviewed, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, I'm going to basically give you some design challenges. It's a really fun one, though, and I think it's just a good vehicle for us to sort of have some more nitty-gritty conversations about this stuff. Okay, so the design challenge is called Golden Homes. And so what I want you to do is I want you to imagine a large kind of enterprise level senior living company. Okay. But they're an alternate to sort of the assisted living, those big apartment complexes, basically. So this is part real estate company, part property management, and part service provider. So they're 100% catering to seniors who want to live independently, but not alone, right? So the company owns homes, usually like 3 to 6 rooms in each home. And the company basically helps place seniors into these rooms. So it's sort of like a roommate finder for seniors, for them to get together. And actually also helps provide services. So there's all these, they make partnerships with like Merry Maids or Blue Apron or something to get these services. So it's almost like create your own assisted living home based on what all the folks in the house want. Okay. So what I want you to imagine is, so most of our writing is going to be presented to our residents that are living in these homes, that are living in kind of these pods, right? Or future residents, but we also have other user types. We have the Golden Homes admins, we have the service providers that need to like edit the services that can be kind of like subscribed to for these homes. So imagine that you are the first UX writer being hired. So there's maybe some content strategist, maybe there's an information architect in there, a bunch of UX designers, but you're the first UX writer, which I think that there's a lot of people in a situation like this, since this is kind of this new, not so new, but because it's a much more new job title, UX writing. And a lot of people are really into it, but most people are going to be the first ones getting hired, right? What would be the first thing that you would do? Like, how would you start your process? What would that look like in a scenario like this?
So I think one of the things that is really important for writers is to go into a job and be really open to what the team needs. Because I think, I'll say this, because people will read a book like ours and think, okay, I'm starting a new job. I'm the first UX writer. First thing I should do is get our voice and tone figured out. Well, I mean, that could take a while before your organization is ready to do something as big as like adopt voice guidelines that everyone's using. So one of the things, and this isn't even my idea, but it's someone I interviewed for the book named Michaela Hackner talked about this, about when you join a team, pay really close attention to what they're trying to accomplish and what they need. So maybe they need emails rewritten because they're doing a terrible job communicating, and they're getting a lot of customer feedback that they're confusing and things like that. So I would look for like the glaring issues that people are having, the fires that you can put out and tell a story around them. And I think the thing that writers maybe don't always do, due to how things are set up and sometimes due to just lack of follow through, is make sure you understand the impact of that work that you did. So follow up on the metrics and the numbers and start to show people how words had an impact over time. So that's kind of what I would focus on. Like, what are the most urgent needs? Where do people want help, rather than bringing in my own priorities for what I think needs to happen?
That's great advice. Andy, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think Michael's absolutely right. Like, that's finding ways to, you know, provide value makes a lot of sense in the way that they need it, kind of on the terms of the team you're working with, because later that builds trust and gets them to, you know, to listen to you when you come at them with like your own ideas of what needs to change and update. I mean, I'm absolutely not trying to, brown nose here, Sophia, but I would absolutely start trying to audit and make note of all of the various kind of like objects and entities and pieces of that very complicated ecosystem that you are working with, because it sounds like there's just so many connected parts, right? Like you have to speak to partners, you have to speak to providers, you have to speak to the residents. So before you even start like thinking about like how to speak to them differently, understanding the connectedness of that system is going to be really important. And it's great if there's somebody who's already like mapping that out and that kind of has an idea of what this ecosystem looks like, but often there's not. And your skill as a writer, as somebody who, you know, assigns language to objects and to ideas, can be really useful in like just like letting people develop just like the rhetoric for what it is that they're working on and like, you know, how things connect. So I would probably start with an audit or kind of mapping that out.
Yeah. I mean,
like how UX teaches us.
Definitely. Like I like getting the buy-in with putting out some of those fires and really showing the value of, you know, getting those small wins to show the value, but then at the same time, using your bandwidth, any extra bandwidth that you have to go and do that audit. And I mean, audit the labels, like how many different words are being used to describe a house? Okay. Yeah. We call it a property over here. We call it a home over here. On the marketing site, we call it, you know, a listing. And where is it appropriate to use different words, and where do we need to kind of consolidate and really help reinforce a mental model by cleaning up our language around what we call things and
Yeah, concept mapping is a really good tool for that, or concept diagramming, some people call it. But actually, not just describing the terms, but the relationship they have to each other. So when you say like residents, what do residents do? How do they relate to all these other things? So not just is it right to call them residents, but what are the actions that we're associating with them, and that you know, what are the actions that we're giving them?
Definitely. I mean, that's a huge part of the, I mean, it's the R in ORCA is mapping all the relationships. And we do that through, you know, a concept model. We call it a system model, but whatever. It's, you know, here's the things and here's how they all relate to each other. Because defining the thing is you're defining the thing in context of your particular system. So you have to show how it's relating to the other things. That's part of the definition of the thing.
Yeah.
So how do you balance? So going back to like the, let's get some quick wins. Let's put out some fires. Let's really show the value. But how do you balance that when you start to feel like you're constantly being asked to sort of, how I always put it, think about a cog in the machine without thinking about the whole machine. So you get, you sort of have a laundry list of like, hey, we need to, let's say it's a warning message. So when a senior signs up for a service, they're signing up their entire house, not just them. And apparently that's like a really confusing thing. And now everybody gets charged, right? So we need to fix this warning label. So we need to make it really clear what's happening when you're signing up for a service. But this might be like day three or something. And you actually don't even understand how residents and services and houses all relate to each other. How do you balance that? Like, hey, yeah, I'm gonna help you put out this fire, but also I need to understand the wider context.
Yeah. I mean, if you're you know, helping the team and showing your value and building some trust. I mean, some of the first people I think that you should, you know, kind of turn that trust to are, if you have them, researchers, or if you don't, the people who are connected with the users in some way. So customer service reps, or, you know, the enterprise, the designer who's really bullish on research and has been doing some user testing. Like getting those insights is really important. And I think we'll, you know, kind of can really, really inform your roadmap, right? Like the problems that you're trying to solve and the ways that you can put your language strategy skills to use. The people who are out there just like understanding what is getting in the way of you doing what you're supposed to be doing. So I think that's the kind of the first step in developing relationships with that team is just like, yeah, finding your research partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say two killer skills for writers that often people don't think of because they're not writing skills are asking questions and communicating trade-offs. So a lot of times writers feel like they have to write what they're asked to write. Like, we need this error message. But you can ask, like, why is it appearing? What business decisions are driving it? Why are we signing everyone up in a house? You know, like, why are we giving individuals the right to do that without, you know, like having a feature where other people check in and agree to it? You know, like, those are all things that I would love for writers to just feel more comfortable asking, because that's your job. You can't really write it until you understand those things. And then communicating trade-offs. If they're like, well, we're not going to add that feature, but we need you to write this warning, just say, okay, well, just a heads up, you know, like, this is just a warning. So really solving the problem for people is different. You know, it's mm-hmm. really important to get at the root of the problem and communicate like, hey, not everything is fixable with a new label or with a warning.
Yes, that's such a great point. And that's a great example of something that like, well, why is this confusing? Is it confusing because the label isn't good enough? Or is this confusing because this isn't actually how the system should work? And then we're getting into deeper UX, information architecture, and business process. And that's something that I think that from object-oriented UX can help UX writers with a lot, and kind of give some tools to actually dig into some of those deeper systemic issues. Like, well, actually, what is the relationship? But does it make sense that the direct relationship should be between a house and a service? Or is it actually multiple residents and a service? And the house is just related by proxy because those are the residents that are actually at the house. Kind of bubbling those issues up. And like, this is actually an issue between the relationships between these two things.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about some work that information architect might be doing. So let's say your IA person, or maybe you're kind of like taxonomy, an OUX person might be doing something like that. They're figuring out all the attributes on each of these things. So we've got, here's all the attributes on a house, like the size and the style of the house. And here's attributes on the room, like how many windows does the room have? And does the room have a view? And is it on the first or second floor? Because you might need people wanting to be on the first floor, especially our elder folks. And then you actually have attributes on people too. So you would have maybe something like their preferences for what kind of house, but also what kind of person they are, because we're trying to match up roommates, right? So everything from gender to political preferences, political affiliations. We're basically kind of matchmaking here, interests, hobbies, that kind of thing. So let's say we have an onboarding flow where the user is putting in all their preferences and they're sort of describing themselves, because that is going to actually help match them up. From a UX writing perspective, okay, this is a big challenge. So how much do we explain to the user how their information is being used without overwhelming them? And then also when it gets to even questions about how we're asking these things and how we're explaining it at an attribute level, like something like political affiliation or gender, what is the responsibility of a UX writer, and kind of what level of control does a UX writer have in a situation like this?
I say give no context, just, you know, be real creepy and just match people however the algorithm says you should.
Yeah. Black box it. Total black box.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
Let the machines do all the work and don't ask any questions.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good question, and it just like is so fraught with ways that you can do harm, either explicitly or implicitly, yep. Right? Like, honestly, that question is not much different than the questions that hopefully they're having discussions about at Twitter and Facebook and, you know, those kind of places where you really are like taking attributes on people and then like doing things in the system with them. Mm-hmm. But I think making sure that you, I mean, wow, how do you start? So at a base level, hopefully your team has a level of diversity where it's not just like a bunch of like, you know, young people making assumptions about how elder users might act and mm-hmm. what their attributes are and what they think about and are doing. Like, hopefully you have a team that is reflective in some way of your user base, or has sort of the ability to involve users in the creation or the like planning of this stuff, right? Like, hopefully you have a deep way to like, you know, test and get insights and make sure that, you know, they like you're getting accurate, good, inclusive information when it goes into it. But then also, like, it is, as you said, it's really, really important to make sure that people understand why you're using this information, right? Having some level of transparency. Being able to say like, hey, the reason we're asking you this is because we want to do this with it, or because we can help you be better. We can help you like match you with a better roommate situation. And when we mean that, like when we say that, what we mean is, we're going to match you with people with similar attributes or different attributes or whatever. So hopefully from a, like, that's a situation that you can find yourself in organizationally, is you have a diverse set of teammates and you have a culture where it's okay that you are being transparent about the way we're using data.
Right. Yeah.
And understanding the implications of that, and understanding how, if you aren't in a situation like that, how you can harm users or how you could exclude users. Right. Like, you know, we have a pretty vulnerable set of users. We're trying to make assumptions and collect data about seniors, and you're like, you know, we can really screw this up, and to make sure you're sort of like internally approaching that as well, and just planning for scenarios like that.
Right. And I think like, well, just taking the political affiliation piece, that one piece, yeah, of metadata, I mean, do we, because there's a business case as well that we want to match people up in ways where we're not going to have turnover, right? Because, yeah, turnover might be expensive for the business, that, you know, a roommate situation doesn't work out and then they want to move. So, you know, how do we match up people like-minded, or how do we even encourage people to, there gets to this whole, like, this whole ethical question as well, as how much of a, do we create, continue to create these filter bubbles, do we say, or, I mean, from a, I could see from a content strategy, UX writing perspective, if you're, and this is sort of where I want to pull the conversation together, is if you are in there early, and when we're still kind of blocking out what the attributes are, you might also say, okay, well, we need to ask about political affiliation, but do we also ask, do we ask what your political affiliation is, or do we say, what political affiliations are you okay with being around? Are you being matched with? And by default, everything is selected. So kind of having those smart defaults and saying, like, okay, we're going to assume that you don't care who you're being matched with, and they would have to actually uncheck it, or some sort of UI pieces like that about what the default selection is, or even how that question is phrased. Maybe it isn't, what's your political affiliation, and just assume that we're just going to match you up with people that have similar political affiliations, and more about what is your tolerance for being matched with people of other political affiliations, and how can we kind of be more encouraging that way? I guess, again, to pull this all together. So one thing that I see, so in the OEUX process, one thing we do is we figure out all the attributes, and then we go through deeper requirements of those attributes, where in this case, maybe we would have, you know, that we have the political affiliation. We might also have gender. We might also have something like, what style of house do you like the most? And if you're involved earlier in the process, before we have wireframes, and before the wireframe with like the lorem ipsum, you know, help copy or something like that is put in there, you just need to add the copy in there, or add that extra explanation. Being in the conversation early, where we can start flagging certain attributes for UX writing. So we might say, okay, house style, probably that's fine. We probably don't need a whole lot of explanation on that. But something like gender, like, okay, let's flag that, because we're going to need some really nuanced UX writing around that, and why we're asking for gender in this scenario, and how we ask for gender, and what kind of values we present to a user there. Same with political affiliation. How do you feel about how to get involved earlier in the process when information architecture is actually happening, and what that would look like ideally?
So, I would think that, okay, I'll give you the cheap answer, which is like, I hope they take your course and read your article and learn how to do it, right? Like, as a UX writer, there's no reason you shouldn't be creating an object-oriented UX approach to what you're building and be the one driving it. So that's one thing that I just want to like put out there into the world, is that maybe as a writer, you need to be more open to, you know, visual thinking, to mapping experiences, to all these things. So that's one caveat I'd give. And I would just also say, starting with the language, like, you know, how I talked about that pair writing approach, that can be really good to work through with visual designers. So, you know, assuming your product designer is someone who took that first pass at the IA, at the structure, then you can start to say, okay, like, let's write what's on this screen before you even design anything, you know, just kind of interject and put that out as an idea. Let's try this and see where it takes us. Because often I think product designers are really open to that. They just haven't worked any other way than to start by putting visual things together. Mm-hmm. So those are my thoughts on, you know, what to do and how to get involved earlier.
Yeah, definitely. All right. We are coming to the end of our time together. I got through about one third of my questions. So I will definitely be bothering you for a follow-up, maybe in like 6 months, a year or something. There's so much more to talk about here. Yeah. Thank you both so much for being on the podcast. I will follow up with you and get all the links. Is there anything else actually that you want to make sure to point people toward, other than your book, Everybody Should Get Writing is Designing? Anything else we want to point our OEUX listeners to?
Maybe just our website, writingisdesigning.com. We have a little regular newsletter that goes out. Sometimes we do workshops that should have relevant information for people.
Wonderful. Yes, highly recommend the workshop. I've heard a lot of good things about it. So thank you all so much for being on the podcast, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!